Welcome to the One Last Sketch podcast, a show dedicated to science fiction, fantasy, and alternate history this time, I guess. It's episode 19. I'm Michael, your host.
I'm Corey, his loyal guest.
And today we're talking about Philip K. Dick's The Man in the High Castle. Released in 1962, Philip K. Dick's a pretty famous author. I don't think he needs much introduction from us. This is, I think, considered one of his best books.
It's considered both one of his best, and I'm pretty sure it's one of his most highly acclaimed. He won, I believe, a Hugo, possibly a Nebula for it, and I think it won a few others as well. So,
yeah, I can't say I've actually read that much Philip K. Dick before this, despite how immensely important he is to the science fiction genre. I've read Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep for a science fiction studies class, and that's the only other novel I've read by him, despite him having this enormous output that's kind of staggering.
I hadn't read much of his before reading this book. I'd only read Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep and one short novella, which I forget the title of. It's the one he published in the Dangerous Visions anthology. I've read quite a bit since. I've read Ubik, which is kind of one of his most famous, most important. Deus Irae, which he co-wrote with Roger Zelazny, and Dr. Blood Money, which is effectively a sequel to the movie Dr. Strangelove, albeit unintentionally, and then a short story collection of his, which included a lot of his stuff from the 50s and 60s, including The Minority Report.
Mm-hmm. And it's worth saying here that a lot of his books have been turned into films, actually probably more of his short stories in this case, and they usually don't resemble what they're based on too much, but it's apropos now, because Amazon released a pilot for The Man in the High Castle a while ago, and I think last week it was announced that The Man in the High Castle is getting a full season on Amazon.
I'm sure we'll get to that in due time, but as far as adaptations go, probably the most famous example is Blade Runner. It is actually based off of Do Androids Dream of Electric Sheep. Having read the book and seen the movie, there's quite a bit of difference. Both thematically...
They have one scene in common.
I think Dick actually was on the set, and from what I've been told, aesthetically, it was basically what he'd envisioned. It's just there's so many small little details in the book and themes and ideas that just don't make it into the movie. As I'm sure we'll talk about in this, alternate realities and the nature of what is real is a big theme in his work, and that was no different in Androids, which just did not cross into Blade Runner, at least not to the same extent.
Yeah, it's also kind of a hard theme to pick up on film, I find.
It can be, yeah.
Yeah, and I've heard that the pilot to The Man in the High Castle also suffers from the problem of, well, maybe not a problem of not adhering to the plot, but not addressing the key themes that Dick's books are pretty famous for.
Yeah, I've got comments on that, but I'll wait till we get there.
Yes. Anyway, as I mentioned obliquely in the introduction, this is an alternate history. Among other things, it's 1962, marijuana is legal in the Western United States, colonization of the solar system has begun, there are rocket planes, and a bunch of farmland has been reclaimed from the Mediterranean Sea. I think that's about it. Did I miss anything, Corey?
You missed the big plot point about the Allies losing World War II, and the world basically being divided between the Axis powers.
Yeah.
The way it's set up in the world is the eastern half of the United States is controlled by the Germans. The western Pacific states are controlled by the Japanese. There's a small buffer zone in between, and the rest of the world is divided accordingly. Italy has a small empire in Europe, but they're really just a bit part to form a buffer state in Europe.
Apparently Canada still exists.
Canada apparently... Yeah, Canada apparently does and has a greater degree of freedom and independence than places like the U.S., but that being said, they still live under the shadow cast by the former Axis powers. What I think is very interesting about the book, too, is there's a Cold War going on. It's just instead of the communist Russians versus the capitalist, well, basically Americans, it's a Cold War between fascist states. The Imperial Japanese and the Nazi Germans have a Cold War going on still. So they won, now they're fighting each other.
Yeah, we have a few characters in here that are followed. Their stories generally don't intersect that much. But when they do...
they intersect in important ways, just not very overt ones.
And not frequently.
Yeah.
So there's Mr. Tagomi for the Japanese side. I believe he's one of the administrators in the government in the occupied Pacific States of America.
Mm-hmm.
Robert Childen, a dealer in authentic American artifacts. Frank Frank, one of the people who makes those authentic American artifacts.
Frank is also an important character because he's a Jew, which, again, Nazis won the war, so that ties into some elements of his story.
Well, it's the case that the Japanese are expected... They don't have death camps on the Japanese side for Jews, but if someone is arrested and they find out their Jewish ancestry, they're immediately put under German jurisdiction and deported to go to a death camp. Mm-hmm. There's another character, Frank Frank's estranged... Are they divorced or are they just separated?
I don't remember. It's been quite a while since I've read this, to be honest.
Well, Juliana.
They're at least separated. Yeah.
Yeah. And then this person doesn't have as much of the narrative as these other characters, but Mr. Baines is supposedly an ambassador from Sweden, which is also ostensibly independent.
Mm-hmm.
So while we do follow these characters and their arcs, it's really hard to say if there's any kind of overarching plot we could talk about. As far as I could summarize it, what we see is that the Reich Chancellor Bormann dies, and there's a power struggle in his wake, and these various characters get caught up in the very small and large repercussions of that event.
Yeah, like you said, it's very hard to nail down one specific narrative arc to the story. You've got a lot of smaller ones. I think if there is any arc, like overwhelming arc to the book, it's simply life in this world, really. And I know that's quite vague, and I think it's meant to be. It's just, here is this world, and here's what's happening in it. And that's really the closest there comes to being an overarching story. I will say, despite the lack of overarching narrative, it works really well.
I would agree on that point. So, from our completely inadequate plot summary that we've just given, but the hope is that you've probably already read the book by now, so you don't need us to walk you through. We're going to move to one of the most important themes, maybe the most important theme of The Man in the High Castle, which is this idea of authenticity. As we've stated, there's not really a driving plot. It's very sedate. And you think in a book about Nazis winning the war that the main theme explored would be the evils of fascism and so on. But that's mainly in the background here, and this idea of authenticity, what's real, what isn't, what is reality, what's unreal, seems to take the forefront in almost every scene you read.
That's a very common theme throughout Dick's work in general. Like I said, I've read a bit of it at this point, and to some extent or other, that ties into just about everything he wrote. It was very much an idea in the back of his head. Do you have any examples you wanted to start with, maybe we could talk about?
Well, we can start with Frank Frank, or Fink, depending on which name he has. He works in a factory that makes authentic, in quotes, American artifacts. There's this growing trade in these cultural objects from the past in the United States the Japanese are interested in. They're not really interested in buying anything produced now, any kind of modern 1962 art coming out of the United States.
Art, artifacts, culture. The perception is that because the Americans have lost the war, any modern culture they have is really just an extension of the colonizing Japanese. So the part of their culture that was actually their culture, it's the Old West. It ties back into that myth Americans like to have about, you know, the cowboy times. And so artifacts from that time become very desirable. The problem is there aren't really that many, or there's only so many of them to go around. So Frank works in manufacturing them. They make fake antiques, which, I mean, this is something that happens today even. And I know people who work in museums have a bit of a field day with it. To put it mildly. Mm-hmm. But I mean, in terms of authenticity, we've got two examples in that alone. First off, Frank is making fake antiques. A lot of them seem to be pistols and Winchester rifles, oddly enough. The other element of it I mentioned, he uses an assumed last name because I said he is Jewish. So he, just to survive, needs to manufacture an identity. He is pretending to be something other than what he is, simply because that's the necessity of his situation.
Yeah, and there's a very telling scene where the owner of the factory, Wyndham Matson, is taking a girl out, and he shows her, I have this lighter from Roosevelt, and in this universe, Roosevelt was assassinated, I think within his first year of presidency.
No,
and
he takes... Sorry to interrupt. That was a real event. I forget the specific details, but there was an assassination attempt on Roosevelt, I believe, when he was running for office. And the assassin missed. In the universe of the book, he didn't.
Yes. So at the time of this assassination attempt that does succeed in The Man in the High Castle, Roosevelt had a lighter, and Wyndham Matson owns it. He also has a fake lighter. And he shows them to the girl and says, can you actually tell which one is real? Mm-hmm. And of course she can't. He knows which one is because he knows there's a scratch there. But he says, okay, now if I bring out the authenticity papers for the one that's real, do you believe it? And she does. But then he asks, do you believe that the object is the real one? Or is it the papers that are making it the real object? And all the it's the idea that all the memories that get attached to an object are more important than the object itself.
Well, exactly. Like, I mean, here you've got a case of they can make a fake, or they can make a replica of this lighter that's just as good, looks the exact same, works just as well, maybe better, but because a piece of paper says it was there and this is in fact it, it makes it more authentic, or perceived to be more authentic and more real and more important. The truth is, and I think what Dick's kind of playing with there is, it is just a lighter. It doesn't matter who owned it, where it was. Ultimately, it was just a lighter, and only because, like you said, only because we attach these ideas to it does it matter. And the only reason they're able to attach those ideas to it is because a piece of paper says it is real. And, I mean, quite frankly, how real is the piece of paper to say that?
And this is actually a big problem for Robert Chilton, the store owner, because Frank Frink comes in one day and says, oh, your pistols are fakes. The thing is, everybody knows that there's a trade in fake artifacts. The problem is it just takes one case where somebody actually says it, and that will cause the trade to collapse.
Yeah, just to backtrack a little bit, Frank is pulling a bit of a joke here, both intentionally... Well, no, he's pulling a bit of a joke for business reasons. He's left his job at this point. He and a friend are trying to start their own business making new items. They're actually trying to start an American culture and an American art. I mean, they don't frame it that way at the beginning, but that's what it evolves into. Or that's what the idea evolves into. So part of the way they figure they can scare up some business is by introducing some doubt. Given Dick's political inclinations, I do think there could be interpreted as being a somewhat subtle commentary there. This whole economy exists around fake artifacts, and like you said, all it takes is one person to say, hey, these are fake, for it to collapse. Well, I mean, really, the economy's no different. Or any economy's no different. It's built around abstract notions, many of which are just made up. So really, what holds them up?
There is no physical change in the economic system if somebody finally admits that the artifacts are fake. The people who make them know they're fake, the store, the people who buy them often know that they're fake.
And the store that sells them certainly knows they're fake.
Yes, but the whole point is you can't say it out loud.
Yeah, I think it's after Frank tells the store owner that they're fakes, I think he even phones the factory owner and complains about it. And if I'm remembering correctly, there's a line about, oh, you know, I'm annoyed with these lousy fakes. Well, you know that they're fakes. It's not that they're fakes that annoys me. It's that they're so lousy.
Yeah. He's not complaining about the fact, oh, you gave me fakes. He's complaining somebody was able to tell it was a fake. Even though in this case, he knows it's a fake because he made it.
Yeah. And again, what is real? What sense does realness matter? I mean, yes, they're modern reproductions of guns that were used 100 years ago. They still work just as well. They still look just as good. They're still largely made of the same materials. What is authentic? And again, it's just the question is constantly being repeated through these kind of actions. Because it really, I mean, on one level, it matters only because we think it does. But if you put both of them on the table in front of you, it doesn't. They're the exact same.
Mm-hmm. And the question applies to the narrative of the book itself, because within The Man in the High Castle, there is another novel called The Grasshopper Lies Heavy, which is, the title comes from a biblical quote.
Yeah, it's a book within a book.
That book within a book is another alternate history, except in this alternate history, Roosevelt survives this assassination attempt, and the Nazis lose the war.
Yeah. What's interesting about the Grasshopper Lies Heavily, though, yes, the Allies win the war, but it's not winning the war the way they actually did. I forget some of the specific details, but the war doesn't play out the way it did in reality. It plays out differently. I believe the Allies crush the Soviets as well, as opposed to allying with them.
Yeah, at the end of at least what's described in the novel, the British Empire becomes ascendant and essentially takes over the world.
Yeah, and then a Cold War erupts between the Americans and the kind of resurrected British Empire.
Mm-hmm. And it is revealed by the end that the book within a book is quote-unquote real, but is just as real as the reality the characters are living in, which is this book you're reading.
You, as a reader living in reality, are reading about a fictional universe in which a fictional universe exists that is closer to your reality, but is still wrong. Tying that back in, like we said, Dick had a very big thing on authenticity and what is real. He was a very big believer in parallel universes and the idea of just if one event had been different, the whole world would be different. And so largely what this book is meant to do is to make you question, you know, which reality is the real one? Did we really win the war? Did we really win the war the way we did? I mean, obviously we did, but does another universe exist where we didn't and where it played out in this way or that way? Or do the two alternate universes described in this book both exist somewhere, somewhen?
And to confuse things even further, there might be a third universe within this book that Mr. Tagomi visits at one point. He's sitting on a bench.
That's when he's suffering the mental breakdown, right?
Yes. Okay. And then he sees that there aren't any pedicabs, and he sees the city he's in as 1962 in our world.
Yeah, now is it explicitly stated it's our world, or is it just very strongly implied? I don't remember.
It's at least very strongly implied in that there's, I think, an overpass being built or something of that sort that being built in 62.
Tying in again, though, with what is real and what's authentic, yes, it's entirely possible a character in the book is looking into our world, or it's entirely possible a character in the book is looking into yet another possible world that very similarly mirrors ours, but is not exactly ours.
So, at least in one instance, there is the possibility brought up that you can travel between these parallel universes.
On some level,
if you're in the right mental state. It's not entirely clear how this happens, however.
Dick was also a very big believer in certain types of hallucinogenic recreational drugs. I think to say he experimented is downplaying it somewhat. But again, the idea of an authentic experience, is a hallucination any less real? Does it show something that's real? Does it give you another glimpse of reality or a glimpse of another reality? Like, again, I know I'm repeating myself a lot, but the book very much repeats these questions. I wouldn't say it bludgeons you with them, but it doesn't let you escape them either.
And I also feel that this theme seems even more applicable now than maybe in 1962, in that we seem to live in a cultural moment that's obsessed with being authentic, having an authentic voice, authenticity in general.
Mm-hmm. Well, we also live in a point in history, scientifically speaking, where the idea of parallel universes is becoming more accepted and, I want to say, largely more credible.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I've read some stuff on quantum mechanics. I don't possess the scientific expertise to really grasp it fully, but just on a layman's level, the way it's been explained to me, physicists are very much taking this seriously. They're very much considering the idea that it's real and gathering evidence that it could be.
Yeah. Now we're going to throw in another complicating factor on top of this discussion, in that there is yet another book that's very prominent in The Man in the High Castle, is the I Ching.
Yes.
The I Ching is a book or set of books from the Warring States period in China that, if not used as an oracle, can be used as a consulting device. And you basically randomly generate these various, I believe they're called hexagrams, right?
I believe so, yes.
Yeah, you can generate a hexagram. You generate them line by line through you can use the reads that they use in the book, or there's other randomizing factors you can use.
You can toss coins, or you can throw sticks, or I'm sure there's variants using dice, although don't quote me on that. But yeah, it's just different ways of generating certain combinations of numbers that direct you to certain lines and certain passages that are meant to reveal, if not the future, then a certain truth about it, I believe.
And if anyone's interested in casting your own I Ching hexagram, you can do it online. It's much simpler than what the characters have to do here.
Well, just an interesting thing about the I Ching, before we talk about its relevance as a plot device, is its relevance to the story as a writing device. I caught a bit of this in a documentary one time. Philip K. Dick obviously read the I Ching, especially when he's writing this book. And what he did is, when he got stuck, like when he was having writer's block, he would take the I Ching, he would cast it from the perspective of his characters trying to find out their own future. And whatever future revealed to them, he would, as a writer, make that future happen. Which, it's a very difficult way to write a book, but I mean, a very cool idea and a very interesting thing to try, I'm sure.
And what's even better about that is that the author of The Grasshopper Lies Heavy, Othard Abdinson, is stated in The Man in the High Castle to have written The Grasshopper Lies Heavy using the I Ching.
Yeah, he consulted it, and it revealed that there was this story that he had to tell, and the reason he had to tell it, according to the I Ching, is because it's true. So again, going back to the nature of multiple realities, like I said, the book is raising the argument that there are multiple forms of reality, and that any and all of them hold true on some level.
This is Juliana's main plot thread, if you can call it that, in that she's going to visit the author and has the contention that he wrote the book using the I Ching, and then it's confirmed using the I Ching that The Grasshopper Lies Heavy is real or true, which is something she has felt throughout the book, that there's something wrong with the reality they're in, and it's not real. On the other hand, whether The Grasshopper Lies Heavy is any more real than the reality she lives in is anyone's guess.
Well, I think that very much ties in with Philip K. Dick's whole thought process, though. Like, I mean, he unfortunately didn't have an easy life, and he struggled with much of his life to determine if he did in fact live in a state of reality, or if do I live in a benign universe, a malevolent one, or an ambivalent one? And there were very much parts of his life where he felt in a very pronounced way that he lived in a hostile universe that actively tried to suppress him. Well, not suppress him, that actively tried to cause him harm. So, I mean, I think you could argue that the characters are expressing some of his own fears and anxieties, and I think you could argue they're also expressing what is a very easy anxiety to have.
Well, there is also a sense that's brought up in this book that all books and stories are alive in some way, perhaps real in some way. In this case, a specific passage about where Mr. Tagomi is talking about the I Ching and how the I Ching is this thousand-year-old book. Why are we living our lives by it? But it's because the book is still alive, just like the Bible is still alive, or any other narrative that exerts influence on the world.
Well, it doesn't even have to be
still alive.
I'm sorry, it doesn't even have to be a narrative to still be alive. The Analects of Confucius are far from being a narrative, and they're still alive, and they're still very much used. Friedrich Nietzsche's work, Aristotle, Plato. I mean, yes, some of them worked in narrative, but not all of them did by any means. And those ideas are still alive, so in a way those works are still alive. Just a quick side note, we may be pronouncing it wrong. It may be I Ching. I could be wrong. I could be wrong on that, though.
We probably should have just called it the Book of Changes to avoid that problem. But
a bit late now.
Yeah, a bit late now. Not up on my pinyin pronunciation. Or maybe it's Wade Giles. Probably Wade Giles if this is 1962. So, now that we've covered what I think are the major themes explored, or which take the forefront in The Man in the High Castle, I think we can finally talk about Nazis.
Yeah,
Do you agree?
Yeah, sure. They're Nazis. I don't mean that facetiously. It is the Nazi Party as it existed in World War II. It is the Nazi Party as it's known to history. Fascist, destructive, violent, very hate-fueled. Like, it is the nightmare we knew. It's just made real because it applies on a much bigger scale. Or made more real, I should say.
Yeah, if there is an earlier two-parter podcast that I did with Alistair Cherney about alternate histories, and we spent a good chunk of time talking about what is probably the most popular alternate history subgenre, or at least scenario, of Nazis winning the war. I think out of all the alternate history books written, this has been the most popular. The usual pitfall, and we discussed this in that earlier episode, is this idea that after a few decades, Nazi Germany is going to normalize and kind of fall into the same pattern as the USSR had done, in that the excesses grow moderate as the need for a stable state arises. This is what usually turns me off of most of these alternate history scenarios. That does not happen in The Man in the High Castle.
My experience has been that the most common alternate history scenario of World War II, and this is one of the reasons I've been somewhat turned off the TV show, is because they completely distorted it to make it this way, is that the Nazis win the war, but we're still brave, noble, spirited Americans / Brits / French, and we're going to keep fighting on until we win because we're right and for God and country and blah 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 blah, all the same propaganda crap you always get. Frank Fink actually has one part where he's reminiscing about how after the war he and some buddies buried their weapons swearing they'd fight again, but as time went by they realized it wasn't worth it. And that's one thing I like very much about this book, is it takes itself seriously enough to acknowledge how ludicrous the scenario of fighting on is. Not because you don't want to, but simply because the circumstances don't permit for it. They don't allow it. And if you try, they're going to grind you into the ground. And I like that this book is just, it's not we are the heroes fighting on still, it's here's the world we live in, and this is the reality we're trying to cope with. And from what I've read of the adaptation for the television show, they very much ignored that and went with the whole we're the brave resistance fighters. Sorry, that's not to say the show's badly made. I'm sure it's quite good. It's just, it's not what this book is about, and it's not what it tries to do.
Yes. There is this as we've said before, even introducing the book in this episode, this is the day-to-day life under mostly Japanese occupation. We don't really see that much of the German side.
Yeah,
here.
It's the book itself is set predominantly in the Japanese-occupied Pacific states. So California, Washington, I'm forgetting one. Between Washington State and California.
Our geography is terrible.
Yeah, my apologies to American listeners, but
I'm drawing a blank, but there's an atlas right beside me. So, oh man, this is great for podcasting, flipping through an atlas. Such a visual medium.
Yeah, for anybody under the age of 15, an atlas was Google Maps in book form.
Oregon. There we go. Atlases can be useful. What do you know? Mm. Because you just don't want to make the clicky noises on your keyboard to Google something. So we have the general atmosphere of oppression and not being able to fight on in the Man in the High Castle. What we see of the Nazis is pretty oblique. We don't have any viewpoint characters who are living under Nazi occupation, but we do hear about what's been going on.
Yeah, a lot of the Nazi activities are very much in keeping with fascist ideology, obviously. After the war, fascism is largely built around the idea of needing conflict. You need an enemy to overcome. So as a result, in the book, the solar system is being explored, spaceships are going out, and the reason for that is because without anybody to fight, the Nazis needed a new enemy, in quotes, to overcome. And in this case, that was a technological limitation, was its own enemy. So there's always that sense of striving. So as a result, they're the ones out in space where the Japanese are at a very distinct technological advantage in that they haven't left Earth yet.
Yeah,
They're at a technological disadvantage.
There is this idea among historians about Nazi ideology being based around perpetual revolution, which is why this idea of a normalized Nazi state that you see in so many alternate histories doesn't work for me, because it does not fit with that core ideology of these groups. As shown in the book, various groups that are competing with each other within the Nazi regime. There's no longer a Gestapo, they're the SD. There's the SD, the SS, the Luftwaffe, the Wehrmacht are all jostling for positions.
Sorry, correct me if I'm wrong. Hitler died just before the events of the book, and so now it's all the members of his cabinet are kind of squabbling with internal politics to take over.
It's not clear when Hitler died. It looks like... Was another interesting point for me was that it seems Hitler is dead and then Bormann became the Reich Chancellor but did not become the Führer.
Right.
Because they still say Heil Hitler, so they still consider Hitler the Führer even though he's passed on, or at least a vegetable suffering from syphilis.
Yeah, it's like a deification, effectively.
Yeah, so Bormann is able to keep this machine running without the apocalypse coming, essentially. Mm-hmm. But when he dies, all cards are on the table, all the various groups are jostling for position, wanting to become, if not the next Reich Chancellor, then maybe even the next Führer, and will bring about the final program, mm-hmm. the end of the road that will come if you follow Nazi ideology.
Which is atomic war, effectively, to wipe out everything.
It is the twilight of the gods.
Yeah.
Now, the end of the world, Götterdämmerung, I don't know how to pronounce it.
Götterdämmerung, I believe.
Yes. The Nazis believed they were at the end of history. This idea of the Thousand-Year Reich was that there would be complete stasis after Nazi victory. There would be no enemies left. Nazis are the end of history. Mm-hmm. And because of this perpetual revolution going on, there's this accelerating madness within the Nazi state, mm-hmm. in the Man in the High Castle, reaching ever further and further, basically a flailing against the idea the universe is uncaring. They're trying to show that humankind matters. Mm-hmm. Humankind is going to conquer the stars, and if they can't achieve this, then they're going to destroy themselves when they're doing it. And there is no way they can achieve it, so any scenario is going to lead to a nuclear war that wipes out all life.
I should probably point out, the way the characters know this, because as I said, most of them are in kind of California area, largely through news reports, but there is one, the character who claims to be from Norway,
Mr. Baines?
Mr. Baines, thank you.
Yeah, he claims to be from Sweden, but he doesn't know Swedish. He says he's a Jew, but that's also not certain.
Why? He is effectively a member of the Nazis' own internal intelligence. He's a secret police member. Effectively, he doesn't overtly defect, but his role in the book is he's flying to California to meet with a high-ranking Japanese official to warn them what the Nazis are planning, to warn them where things could go. Because as we mentioned, there's still very much a Cold War going on in this book between the two sides. Like in the world we live in, just because the Allies... Sorry, let me try this again. Like in our world, just because the Americans and the Russians were allies, didn't mean they trusted each other or liked each other after the war. This book parallels that in that just because the Japanese and the Germans were allies doesn't mean they like each other after the war. And 20-some-odd years on, yes, they have a rough peace, but there are still buffer states, there's still saber-rattling... There's still cloak and dagger stuff happening in the shadows as they try to, you know, maneuver for position. And this is all implied. I mean, very little of it's actually shown in the book.
Yes, however, with Bormann's death, there's a very real possibility that various factions in the Nazi Party have this plan to nuke Japan. Not just the major cities in Japan, it appears they want to destroy Japan entirely.
Which includes Japan's entire empire, which is effectively half the world.
Yeah. And with Goebbels taking the reins, or it seems that this is the way things are going by the end of the book, the implication is inevitably what happens after the Man in the High Castle is the end of the world. Which, you know, if you're going to have a Nazis win the war scenario, you might as well have a bleak ending.
I think it's a realistic one for the scenario, though.
Yeah, and as I've said of other alternate histories that don't go this way, if you look at various internal documents about what was being planned, if there was a Nazi victory on the Russian front, they were going to cause mass starvations, round up all the Slavs, and basically exterminate them all in what would be an impossibly huge genocidal campaign. And it's clear that they were already setting up the mechanisms with which to do this while they were occupying the Eastern Front. It doesn't feel like they would ever stop.
Like I said, fascism, Nazism especially, requires an enemy. It requires something you can target and victimize and scapegoat and kill. I mean, I certainly don't see why the world described in the novel would be any different. Okay, you've wiped out one undesirable group, you target another one. You've run out of undesirable groups, well, you create one. Like, it's a very self-destructive attitude, effectively.
Yes, and that's even pointed out with the occupation of Africa in this novel.
There
appears to have been a massive genocidal campaign that has not only devastated the people of the continent, but apparently destroyed the economy and any viability of the continent itself. What few black people we see in the novel are slaves. Slavery has returned, at least in Japan, on the Japanese side.
Yeah, and it's not like implied slavery or, you know, effective slavery. They actual, like, on paper, they are, like, the worst elements of what the word expresses or what the word stands for.
And from what it seems like on the Reich side, there are none left. And, yeah, when you have scenarios like that happening, the colonization of the solar system is not going to save mankind in any way. Yeah. So, after that uplifting conversation, We can turn our attention to the way the Japanese are depicted here, which I would say is not very well. I don't mean that because as occupiers they're shown as not as cruel as the Nazis and so on. That's not the context I'm going with. More, while I can see the German scenario as realistic, the way the Japanese are depicted here relies a lot on stereotypes of East Asian cultures in the 1960s.
Yeah.
And conflating East Asia as being one giant conglomerate culture instead of taking into account the
vast
specifics
number of ethnic groups.
Yes,
and
the specifics of Japanese
and, yeah.
culture, the specifics of the imperial regime at the time of the occupation, because we've talked about how important the I Ching is in this book, mm-hmm. but there's no reason why Mr. Tagomi would be using it, or the Japanese would introduce it, or why so many people have it, and why Tagomi keeps on talking about Tao and keeping the balance of the Tao, because Taoism was not something the imperial regime encouraged particularly, and they generally look down on a lot of stuff derived from Chinese culture at the time of the occupations.
Yes and no. I mean, yes, obviously, because Japan during World War II tried to colonize China to appalling effect, unfortunately. But at the same time, many elements of Japanese culture, many elements of many East Asian cultures are based off of what was created and founded in China.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Buddhism comes from India originally, but it's through the Chinese interpretation and the Chinese versions of it that it's introduced to many other countries in the area. Japanese literature is largely based in Chinese literature. It used to be one of the measures of a samurai gentleman to be able to read and understand and talk about the Chinese classics. So, I mean, yes, I can see the argument you're making about how, or certainly is the historical examples of how during World War II what certain attitudes would have been, but just because something's an attitude doesn't mean it stops being part of the culture.
Yeah, that's true. It's more, it may takes things a little bit too far in Philip K. Dick's case, and I don't think this is Philip K. Dick's fault particularly, or just the atmosphere of the 60s and how stereotypes were applied.
You can't completely separate a work of literature from the context it's written in, and this is very much a product of its time in that regard.
And in a lot of other ways with the 1960s. But now that we've thoroughly discussed this setting, any final thoughts on your end?
As bleak as we're making the book sound, it is a phenomenal read. It's certainly my favorite work by Philip K. Dick, probably one of my favorite books in general. I mean, what we're talking about, I think, is a testament to how good the book is. If you're looking for a very layered read that will make you think but is still very readable, it's certainly a good book to turn to. I think, as weird as it sounds, even though it's set in an alternate world, it does offer some interesting commentary on our own. Certainly the climate in which it was written, which would have been right in the middle of the Cold War.
And this is explicitly stated in the book at one point, too, I believe.
Yeah. I'm sure it is. And, I think I've read a number of things that have described Philip K. Dick as one of the most important writers of the 20th century. And I think it's fair to say that if that's true, then this is one of his most important books. And for that reason alone, it's worth reading.
Yeah, for its remarkably short length, it packs a lot.
Yeah, I mean,
this is another case like with our Book of the New Sun podcast, where we talk and we talk and we're only at the edge of what you could discuss in this novel.
Yeah. Well, one thing I will say about Man in the High Castle, it's a dense book, but at no point does it feel dense. It's very readable. Like, it's a very enjoyable book to just read.
Uh-huh.
If you don't mind a little bit of bleakness.
Yeah, it's one of those things where there's no driving plot, per se. And yet you still are reading with interest and want to get back to it and find out, quote-unquote, what happens next.
Mm-hmm. There's still very much a sense of forward progression, though. It still feels like there's a purpose to where you're going, even if it's not always clear what that is. I thought I had something, but I guess that's it.
Well, I think that's about it. Are you planning to watch the TV show?
I'm willing to give the TV show a try. I'm not going to completely write it off having not watched it, but I will be approaching it with a bit of skepticism.
Yeah, agreed. And considering how many Philip K. Dick adaptations before have failed me in various ways, and that's not even having read the original stories, just, like, why did I watch that Total Recall remake of the play? That was awful! My confidence level, let us say, is not high.
Yeah.
So, thank you for talking about this novel, Corey.
Oh, thank you for inviting me to. Again, I love talking about this book. I could happily do it for a lot longer than we did.
Yeah, this has been the One Last Sketch podcast. You can find previous episodes on iTunes and Stitcher, or you can visit my website, onelastsketch.wordpress.com, which also has a bunch of articles and drawings and stuff that might interest you. If you enjoyed this podcast, recommend it. Thanks for joining us.